This is Dr. West Connor, founder and president of MedicineCoach.com. Being a pharmacist has provided a great life for me and my family. After practicing a short time, I realized the struggles people were having affording their medication. It was then that I began my quest to help those who were struggling in this area. During this time, I developed several unique ways to both lower your prescription drug costs and greatly reduce the time, your precious time, that you spend actually acquiring your medication. I put these time-tested and proven ideas down in a workbook so anyone could get this information and begin to save. Just because your doctor prescribes a medication for you, you're not forced to take it. Most likely there are other, far less expensive medications out there that you can use and get the same result. I bring this and tons more information to you in the workbook, How to Save Money on Your Prescription Drugs. During my personal coaching sessions, many clients were interested in remedies other than medication. Herbal products, vitamins, and lifestyle changes can greatly reduce or eliminate your need for expensive prescription drugs. The shelves at your pharmacy or grocery store can be a minefield of one concoction after another. I, along with other researchers, sift through the confusion and bring you the real, studied, and science-based products that work for you. In the MedicineCoach.com website, you'll find articles, podcasts, special reports, and interviews all dealing with your health, your medication, and your supplements. Keep checking back at the website for frequent updates. Steve Berkey founded his company, 90 Revolutions, to meet the unique needs of endurance athletes. Injury prevention and performance enhancement are key elements for those training to achieve greater physical outcomes with less pain and more enjoyment. Steve addresses these issues through medical-based bike fits and running analysis that utilize advanced motion software, custom orthotics, and strength and conditioning programs. His physical therapy training with his affinity for running, cycling, and all things outdoors allows him to view training from multiple perspectives, both practical and clinical. 90 Revolutions recently introduced yet another set of aspects and services through the Functional Framework. The Functional Framework is a group of experts that provide services and education in the areas of coaching, nutrition, and sports psychology. Together with Steve's injury prevention expertise, the team of experts works to meet the complete needs of endurance athletes. Everyone from beginners to experts and weekend warriors to serious, consistent competitors can utilize the services of 90 Revolutions. Visit www.90revolutions.com to learn more. Sign up for the free bi-weekly newsletter. Steve welcomes questions and comments through email at steve@90revolutions.com. Hey Steve, this is Wes Connor.
Hi Wes, pleasure to talk to you.
Good, how you doing?
Very good. And yourself?
Good, good. I remember when I first heard about you, I guess about a year ago, I'd been invited over to Dan Miller's house for dinner. My wife and I, we went over there and went into Dan's office and he showed me this, I guess it was like a red rubber band looking thing. And he said, you know, I talked to one of our coaches, this guy, Steve Berkey. I was telling him I was having some shin pain because he walks in the morning. And he gave me this red rubber band looking thing and he told me how to use it. And he says, I tell you, just after a couple of days of working on a thing, I feel like I'm walking on new legs. I don't know how this guy does it, but it really feels like I'm walking on new legs and different legs. I don't have any pain anymore.
That is excellent. Yeah, Dan was talking to me before, and he mentioned that he enjoys walking every day just for some recreational exercise and for peace of mind. And he began to feel symptoms, kind of like shin splints, he described them. So I asked him a couple questions just to get a bit of a history as to what's causing it potentially. And it's difficult to evaluate over the phone. I got some information that may help him. So I provided him a TheraBand. Very easy to do, simple therapeutic exercises just to strengthen the musculature around his ankle and to see if that would help. And I also gave him some suggestions as to whether or not insoles may be beneficial, because there are so many different causes of shin splints. Oftentimes the term shin splints is even a misnomer. It's almost like an umbrella term, where shin splints may in fact be many other types of injuries. It could be an underlying stress fracture. It could be an irritation of a tendon. I'm always there to help out, and if it's a simple, easy cure by doing certain exercises, that's all the better.
You know, like shin splints, so it could be, I mean, a stress fracture. Is that like a hairline break or something on the shin bone, whatever that is, the tibia or fibia? Is that because you're just walking so much that it just doesn't have time to heal, and it's the actual bone that has a small break in it? Could that be some of the causes of pain?
Exactly. Yeah, stress fractures is a weakening or a small, like you described, small hairline fracture of the bone, but they can develop because of many reasons. They're very common in endurance athletes, such as marathon runners or triathletes. It could be because of the constant pounding. The other effects that they have found is that if someone may walk on the inside of their foot a little more than usual, called overpronation, the tendons that attach the different bones can actually start pulling some of the bone away, and that can cause some of these microfractures, if you want to think of it that way.
So the tendons from the knee are pulling, or from the ankle?
It could be anywhere in the body, but in the case of shin splints, yeah, a lot of times it's the tendons and the inside of the lower leg, the inside of the shin, along your tibia.
Is that from just overuse or just, you know, doing it too much? Or does it kind of, because you're, you know, I know they are popular, just like you said. Is that just from kind of overuse and not taking it easy?
It's often found that if someone increases their training program a little more intensely, that could be one cause, because overuse of the tendons. Another thing is it could be the surface that they're running on. Another thing that can lead to it is that if someone has a weakening of the bone, such as osteopenia, which is beginning to osteoporosis, can also lead to it as well.
I think you're supposed to throw away your running shoes after 300 miles or something. So it's better shoes, more like a shock absorber type of shoe that'll help with those shin splints to help prevent them? Or is it just, how do we sort of prevent them, I guess?
Exactly. Well, I think that's the first thing. Definitely you want to look at your shoe wear, and it is recommended about 300 miles. You should make sure that you do replace your shoes, because if you don't have the proper shock support or the proper support for your foot, in case your foot's mechanically reacting improperly to the ground, you have to replace it and have that proper support. Shoe wear is very preventative. Then also you have to think about your training. When you go out there and you begin increasing your miles, you should do it very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes runners use the 10% rule, which means that you increase your distance 10% per week. Even though cardiovascularly your heart is improving, you feel like you're breathing better, the tissues don't adapt as well. So we have to really gradually ramp your training.
Okay.
And usually those are two main things that are preventative when treating shin splints.
You specialize in knee down problems or issues. You just came up with knee down because that's the issues that you were having, or did you find that other endurance athletes were having the vast majority of their issues from the knee down, pain or injuries from the knee down? Is that, and so you decided to kind of niche your area and specialize in that area?
That's correct. I actually personally felt a lot of these injuries. I have been a bit of my own experiment. I noticed that I enjoy running. I enjoy competing in duathlons right now, running and biking events. And I was beginning to have knee pain, and I was increasing my training as I felt appropriately, but I kept having this knee pain, so I wanted to figure out what's causing that. And I went through several courses, took advanced courses to figure out what the potential causes were, because I know that if we walk on an average of 5,000 steps per day, and then we add running into the situation, our feet are taking a beating of several thousand steps. And if something wasn't moving properly, I knew it was causing some damage. So because of that, I started diving into it, learning more information, learning how I can fix myself and fix others around me. And I was also just very fortunate to work with a lot of triathletes in the clinical realm. So I wanted them to have the best care to get back out there in the training season as quick as possible. And it all kind of fell into place where I became the knee down specialist.
So you experienced a lot of these issues yourself, and that's what kind of drove you to this area. Your philosophy is if you have pain, find out what's causing the pain. Is that the issue?
That's exactly right. If you don't cause the pain, you're caught in this redundant cycle where maybe you change your training, or maybe you do take a rest, but then you resume your training, and again, that pain returns. So I think if you determine the cause, then you can prevent it long-term and not have subsequent injuries and any other problems.
Let's say I'm running and I'm getting these shin splints. Now, the best thing would be to, you know, I'm just running casually. I'm not doing competition. I'm not training for a marathon. I'm not doing anything. I'm getting some pain in my shins. Just as a person who doesn't know much about this stuff, should I just take it easy for a week, relax for a week, or instead of run, walk, or don't do anything, or like you had, you know, with Dan with that big rubber band thing, you know, something like that? What would you recommend for someone who's not in a lot of pain, but realizing that, yeah, I'm getting these shin splints now, before they get too bad, what do I do? Do I stop or just take it easy?
You want to take it easy. Body initiates this pain response for a reason. Something is not appropriately moving, or there's some sort of damage. So if you take it easy for a couple weeks, 1 to 2 weeks, in addition, switch out your shoe wear, and then finally start strengthening some of the muscles around that area, just as I provided Dan, and to see if that helps. If you don't see a change, though, within 1 to 2 weeks, that's when you need to consult a medical specialist. There are so many different types of diagnosis that may link to this shin-type pain. So really the first thing is to take it easy. Don't resume that task of running in this case.
So you'd say just relax for a while, let your body heal itself, and then start. And if you're just going to sit for a week or 10 days, you're really not going to fall that far back in your training, or you're not suddenly going to gain 10 pounds if you don't run a mile for a week.
Exactly. Okay. And oftentimes I recommend to runners to incorporate some cross-training. That way their aerobic endurance is not hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to get into cycling, that would be a great replacement just for the meantime.
You're saying don't mask the pain with medication and stuff because, you know, there's damage to the body and you don't want to mask that and further that damage as you continue to run and continue to train and work out because it's only going to make things worse.
Exactly. Right.
What would you recommend for the athlete who's training for a marathon and say the marathon is 2 months away and they're up to 20 miles a couple times a week, I guess if that's how you train for a marathon,
sure.
Trying to get up to that 24 point whatever mile that a marathon is. If somebody's going to run there, they're 2 months out and now suddenly they've got these shin splints. Should they just do the same thing, just sit down for a week, or are there those strengthening exercises with the bands to speed the healing to kind of help them along the way, or should they just kind of suck it up for the next 2 months and with, you know, medication that you don't recommend and get through the marathon and then relax?
If someone is 2 months out from a marathon, they're experiencing shin splints, not necessarily through the entire run, but at a certain point of the run, what I recommend doing is decreasing the running time. That way it gives that tissue some time to heal. I understand that marathoners, they really want to get out there, they're very competitive. So I would never say completely avoid the task when it's really right around the corner. And if they decrease the activity, replace the other time that they need to train and build that aerobic endurance with some sort of cross training. In the meantime, also do some of the strengthening exercises and see if that can help them through those next 2 months. In addition, I would want them to focus on some sort of local anti-inflammatory, for instance, ice. After they run, it still goes cause some irritation. Use some ice just to control it, because if they begin to get some swelling, whether it's swelling enough that we can see or whether it's internal swelling, we want that under control so it doesn't apply too much pressure to the tissue, the healing process. And if they find that they're able to increase the weekly mileage with less pain with that type of program, then I think they'll be okay.
For more information about Steve Berkey and 90 Revolutions, visit 90revolutions.com.
But if they're still caught in the cycle where, you know, they get to running a certain mileage, they always have that pain, well, again, that's your body's way of saying something's wrong, and that's when a medical professional needs to be consulted, because they may be experiencing a stress fracture of the tibia. Or they may be overpronating or have some sort of biomechanical fault, meaning that something's not moving correctly, causing some of this pain.
So you said ice. As far as just the injury goes, I've heard ice for 15 or 20 minutes and then heat for 15 or 20 minutes. Foot soaking vibration, like a foot soak that has the vibration thing in it, will help. Do you recommend ice and then heat or just ice? Or is there any sort of formula that you think heals better than the others?
Yeah, there are specific indications as to when you use ice and heat. When you use ice, that's when you initially have an injury. That's when the inflammatory response is beginning. So you're using the ice to keep the swelling down. And ice, usually use it for 2 to 3 weeks, and that's not to say that that's for every person. If it still hurts when you move it, I would just stay with ice just to be conservative. If it's more stiff, not necessarily painful, that's when you use heat. And you don't want to use heat initially for the fact that inflammation is a heated process. All those cells are rushing to the site of injury, swelling occurs. And if you put heat on too soon, it's actually going to make the swelling worse. So therefore, it's a better idea to be very conservative with the ice, that inflammation under control, so no more damage occurs.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess that makes sense. When you put ice on it, you kind of shrink the blood vessels, which will slow down the fluid being brought to the area, whereas heat would open up the blood vessels a little more, bring more blood and fluid and more healing attributes to the injured area. What about knee pain? Like the most popular, I guess, or the biggest issue that runners or bicyclists or triathletes or biathletes would have with knee pain, is it kind of the same thing, just overuse and sort of the connective tissue, like ligaments and tendons, they just don't have the time to heal, and, you know, they get the small tears from like small muscle tears when you're lifting weights or something. The connective tissue is just wear and tear because you're training so much, you just don't have enough time to heal. The same thing that's going on with a knee or an ankle injury, stuff like that.
In regards to the knee, that is some of the most common things, lack of healing. But really, when it comes to knee injury, the most common diagnosis that you'll see with runners or cyclists is patellofemoral syndrome. And what patellofemoral syndrome is that the kneecap is not tracking in the groove right above the knee joint. So in other words, there's too much rubbing in there. So if the kneecap rubs along the tissue below it and it begins to break down, that's when we start hearing that cracking and that snapping in our knees as we go up and down steps. And oftentimes people will experience in their daily activities, if they're sitting for long periods of time and they transition from a sitting to a standing position, they begin to feel that initial bit of pain. Or if they're walking down the steps, they'll feel some of that pain. Commonly, this patellofemoral syndrome or the breakdown in the cartilage is what cyclists and runners begin to experience. experience. And eventually, that becomes more and more inflamed. Really, we first feel that cracking and hear that snapping, but it gets to a point where it becomes very unbearable, that pain, and that's when the cartilage is beginning to break down to the point where we're actually getting to the nerve endings, and that's when the emergency system of pain kicks in. It's not necessarily because of overuse of certain muscles or tendons or ligaments. The big thing with patellofemoral is in relation to the mechanics of the knee. So you have to figure out why is that kneecap not tracking properly in the groove of the knee joint. And that could be because of muscle weakness. It could actually be the way the foot reacts to the ground. Or it could even be because of the weakness in the hips and lower back.
Everything kind of connects to each other with that. So
exactly.
So you're saying your patella or your kneecap's not tracking right. It's kind of like a glass sliding door running on the track, and it's vibrating or something. It's just not lined up correctly, and over time, it's just rubbing on one side more than the other, and just wearing it out. And like you said, once you get down to the nerve endings, that's when there's that pain feeling, so you know there's an issue, and that's when you have to go and either strengthen the muscles on one side or find out if you're stepping wrong. Is that pretty much the issue?
That's exactly it. Yeah, anything that causes that knee to bend incorrectly, that could occur from the top or in the bottom of the leg.
And how would you find out if you're stepping wrong?
Stepping wrong, in the clinical setting, the way that I would determine as a physical therapist is I take people through what's called a video analysis. So I have them walk or run on the treadmill, depending on what specific activity we're trying to assess. And I slow down the video analysis frame by frame, and I can determine exactly where the chain of events going wrong.
The back of my outside heel always wears out first, but is that commonplace for people to wear out the back of the heel on the outside?
That's a very common area. It's most common when our foot initially strikes the ground that we hit a bit of the outside of the ankle. Mm-hmm. Key is whether or not it's too excessive. Some people actually turn their ankle in almost like they're going to sprain their ankle if you slow down and watch them as they walk, and that scuff mark on the outside of their shoe is actually quite extreme, and that's when a problem really develops, putting too much stress on those ligaments. But normally, when you look at the base of any shoe that's been worn down or has a couple miles on it, you're going to notice that little bit of scuff there.
On the outside of the back of the heel?
Sure.
And
that's one thing you just got to be careful about. Like I said, there are extremes of that. And sometimes if we wear that down too much because of how our foot reacts, that might be a situation where it may need to be looked into a little more detail and whether the shoe needs to be changed or a special insole. But when we're looking at just the heel of the shoe, that's really a very small percentage of what's going on at your foot. So you have to also consider how are the bones reacting in the middle of the foot, out to the toes, because the biomechanical issue can actually be at the arch. And sometimes we'll see that the heel looks like it's moving fine, but the midfoot drops too much. And if the midfoot drops too much, there's a chain reaction. For instance, the knee may rotate in too much. So there are several biomechanical things that you're not going to always determine from the look of the shoe. That might give us a clue if it's extreme enough, but if it's minor, you can't always see what's going on inside of the shoe.
If you're having some pain, if you were to look, and you are a runner, if you were to look at the bottom of your shoe, could you determine sort of what's going on just by the wear pattern on the bottom of your shoe, or is that not really a good way to do it? Your best bet is to just seek out a professional who knows what he's doing or what she's doing and get it diagnosed correctly, or can you just look at the bottom of your shoe and say, okay, it's wearing out on the right side, so I need to concentrate on landing more flat as I'm running, or should you just say, you know what, I need to just go see a professional?
Sure, but to answer the first question, whether shoe wear determines that something's wrong, that's only going to give you a small piece of the equation. There are some shoe wear patterns that really are very indicative of something going wrong. If someone's wearing the inside of the shoe near their arch a little more than usual, that's kind of an odd and proper wear pattern. We know something's going wrong. Again, that's only a piece of the problem. If you're having persistent type of pain, that's when you do need to see a medical professional, because simply looking at the foot involves looking at different parts of the foot and working your way up the chain of events up into the hip and the back.
A medical professional, I'm going to assume that your general family practitioner is not going to be able to perfectly, you know, diagnose, and honestly, he'd probably just give you some anti-inflammatory drugs and send you on your way. So you'd want to go see a physical therapist for this issue, or find like a sports osteopath?
Yeah, most often you want to seek out the professional who's specialized in that type of condition. So in other words, you would start through the chain within the medical field, starting with an orthopedist, preferably someone who specializes in that area where you're injured. An orthopedist then will rule out any underlying issues. For instance, it's not uncommon for somebody to have a meniscus tear of the knee, cartilage, that gives you that padding. And if the meniscus tear is too great, regardless of how many things you adjust the shoe or exercises, it may be a case where they need to address it surgically. So you need to see somebody to make sure that it isn't too bad. But if it's something very minor and it's not contributing completely to your symptoms, the orthopedist will refer to a biomechanical specialist, which in essence is a physical therapist in the medical field.
For more interviews like this, visit medicinecoach.com.
So you really have to seek out somebody local, or could you diagnose something like that over the phone?
You can diagnose a lot of things over the phone. They're very predictable in nature. But the problem is with diagnosing over the phone and just determining what's going on by the history is that it doesn't rule out any underlying type of condition. Someone may have more than one diagnosis or a diagnosis that seems something that may be minor, but you can't really rule that out until you actually go through all the further testing. It's quite difficult to truly diagnose and provide a solution over the phone. There are just too many variables.
If someone tells you what's going on over the phone, you could say, well, most likely this is the issue and that's the issue. But to be absolutely sure, you really need to do a hands-on, go to an office and sit down and either get an MRI, or can you kind of palpitate if there's an issue? Can you just kind of feel with your thumbs or your fingers if it's swollen in a certain area of the knee or ankle? Can you say, yep, you're swollen here, here's the problem?
Yeah, exactly. Oftentimes, your body puts target signs, if you want to think of it, on different areas. Normal tissue is not tender to palpation. Normal tissue is not warm, excessively warm to palpation, and as well, it's not swollen. So by pushing on certain areas combined with our clinical tests, we can really narrow it down and figure out what's going on.
We talk mostly about runners. They would probably have more injuries because of just the constant pounding on the road or on the treadmill or as they're running. What about a bicyclist? If their kneecap wasn't aligned up right, that would be an issue. As far as bicyclists go, I mean, what are their injuries? How do they sort of wear themselves out?
Right on with the knee. It's very common to see bicyclists with knee injuries, and also another area is the back. Cyclists are in this very aero position, whether mm-hmm. they're a triathlete or a road cyclist, and the position's incorrect, and they're putting way too much stress on the back, and it could be a simple fix, such as changing the stem, raising the handlebars, or adjusting the seat. So oftentimes, when I'm working with cyclists, the two main areas include the knee and the lower back.
I guess if you've got your seat up too high and your handlebars down too low, that would make you lean over more than necessary. What would you normally recommend for a bicyclist whose back is just sore because they ride two or three times a week, 15 miles, and now their back is wearing out?
Definitely, with a cyclist with kind of lower back pain at distances like that, I would recommend raising up the handlebars. That would be the first thing. And with the advent of the computers, we sit at that computer for long periods of time, and sometimes individuals note a lot of pain between their shoulder blades and at the neck. And the problem is because of the positioning held in long periods of time. So if you're sitting on a bicycle, just like you would be at a computer for long periods of time, again, you're placing that constant stress on that tissue in an improper position. So if you can put your spine in more of what we call a neutral position, which means it's a position where least amount of stress is placed upon the spine, that would be really the most helpful. The second thing is really focusing on that midsection. You hear a lot of times in the fitness world, working on your core area, which includes the abdominal muscles, the lower back muscles, the hip muscles. That also, again, will help in balancing it out and taking the stress off the back. And then finally, I would look at the seat position. Sometimes the seat is actually tilted too far forward, which causes you to slide into your handlebars. Therefore, you're putting too much stress on your hands, and it may cause you to put your back in a certain position that's improper. Look definitely at seat position. Make sure it's your seat or your saddle is level. Raise up the handlebars by changing the stem. Sometimes simple fixes where you can just take the original stem on the bicycle and flip it upside down, and it increases the inclination. And then finally just working on that core musculature.
Switching the stem on the seat or the handlebars?
On the handlebars.
You're talking foreign to me with stem and inclination. So your seat, as a bicyclist, it should be perfectly flat and horizontal. It shouldn't tilt, or are some people more comfortable with a little bit of a tilt forward or backwards? It's all just an individual thing.
Exactly. Oftentimes, in most cases, you want the seat level. But if you kind of go back to the triathletes, if they're riding a triathlete bike, you'll oftentimes see it tilted down just a little bit because they're leaning forward in that aero position just to take some stress off the tissue on the saddle.
Speaking of the seat or the saddle, one of the questions a lot of guys have when they're riding bikes is the comfort of the seat. For most of us, that's a tender area. The seat that I used to ride, when I used to ride my bike a lot, I wasn't competitive or anything, I just did it for shape. I got the biggest, widest, softest seat I could find. With the seat and with the issue with guys, is it a comfort issue, or are there actually seats that are designed to alleviate pressure from that area?
Well, when it comes to the seats, I find that when professionally fitting cyclists, that is the hardest thing to figure out, what is the exact seat for the exact person. There are many seats out there that are made specifically to alleviate some of the symptoms, but the problem is it's not going to work for everybody. It's really a trial and error basis. General rules is that if someone's going to be cycling for an extended period of time, they don't want a seat that's the nice cushy one, the wider one, because actually that soft seat applies more surface contact to those areas and can cause more rubbing, more chafing, and more pressure in the areas that are going to cause some problems down the road. So oftentimes it's an experimentation, trying to figure out what's the appropriate seat that applies the correct pressure to the correct areas of the pelvis. There are definitely many saddles out there that they have tried to match with the anatomy. For instance, one that comes to mind is the Selle SMP, and it has a bit of a contoured nose to the seat. But really, when it boils down to it, it's experimentation, and the nice, comfy, soft ones don't always cut it.
You can actually fit a bicycle seat to an individual person.
I wish it was that simple. I wish they would come out with something that actually molds and applies the proper pressure to the proper areas. They have done many things. You'll go to bike shops and they'll measure your ischial tuberosities, which are your sit bones, basically, and they would try to match the width of the seat to that. But unfortunately, that's not really where the main problem occurs. It's more as with pubic bone articulates their specific nerves and arteries, eudendal nerves and arteries. That's where the real problem is. And if the nose of the seat is not correct to your anatomy, then it begins pressing on those vital structures, and that's when we get the numbness, and it feels a bit uncomfortable. So there really hasn't been a mold that gets in that area. It's just too hard to mold to.
The seats are standard sizes, but just all different sizes, and you try and find one that fits you best.
Exactly. Yeah, I definitely encourage going to a bicycle shop where they would allow you to trial a saddle or a seat for an extended period of time. That way you can figure out if, in fact, it's the correct one.
And are you strapped into the pedals when you're competitive biking? Or you're kind of locked in? Is that so you could pull up with one leg as you push down on the other?
That's exactly right, yeah. And professional cyclists, they have clipless pedals, which remind you of the bindings of a ski boot on a ski. They design that to maximize the power. So that way you're more efficient throughout the entire pedal stroke.
You're pushing down with your right leg as you pull up with your left leg and vice versa on the next stroke?
Exactly. That's if you have correct pedal stroke, yes.
Are there any ankle or foot issues with bicyclists that they're having, or it's pretty much the knee?
Yes, definitely. A cyclist experience what's called hot foot, which means that they can have pain at the bottom of their foot, or oftentimes it materializes as being a numbness or a tingling. Those symptoms are a result of many factors. You know, one, it could be the shoe wear. The shoes are just simply too tight, and they're applying too much pressure to the bones and the nerves and the blood vessels of the foot. So they begin to feel some of the numbness. Second reason could be that they may not have the correct support within their shoe. And then a third reason deals with how that pedal is positioned at the bottom of the shoe. There are several different types of pedals out there, and someone is predisposed or has a condition such as Morton's neuroma, which is an entrapment of the nerves on the foot, and if they have the wrong type of pedal, it can actually put so much pressure in that area. So you can adjust the pedal to see if that's the correct position to alleviate the symptoms, or they may need to actually purchase a pedal that has a wider surface area, so it's not like one sharp point pressing up in the bottom of their foot.
A little bit before, you were saying the pedals now kind of look like ski clips. Do they have one that would fit your whole foot?
The clipless pedals are a completely different situation, where you have two pieces, the pedal itself and the cleat. And the cleat is screwed or bolted onto the shoe, and it has a mechanism built into it, and everyone is a bit different. They put their foot down onto the pedal, and it locks them in. It's like locking a ski boot into the ski.
It solidly locks your foot in so you can pull up.
Exactly. Yeah, you definitely can move your foot up and down, and even side to side, depending on what kind of pedal you have. When we're cycling, we have to consider that the knee has a bit of a rotation. It kind of boils back to the lower back. It's a similar situation, but neck pain. I've been seeing a decent amount of individuals with neck pain, and it's because they're leaning too far down, and they have to extend their neck too far, and it places too much stress at the lower part of their neck. So oftentimes, the same thing would pertain in order to correct that, raise the handlebars.
Jumping over to a completely different subject, you know, during football season, these guys have turf toe, and they got to sit out for a couple games. What is turf toe? Is it only football players, or can anybody get it who runs on the ground?
Well, turf toe, it came out with the advent of turf. Basically, runners would excessively jam or flex their big toe when they hit the ground, and then what that does is it drains the ligamentous tissue supporting your big toe.
When they're running, they're pushing off with their big toe too much?
it's not always pushing off of their big toe too much. It could be a kicker, and they miss the ball, and they kick into the ground instead. It could be someone that they cut and pivot, and again, that big toe of theirs jams into the ground.
Is it like an acute injury? It's not something that builds up after a while?
Not at all, no. It's usually very acute. It can lead to other things of the big toe where it becomes stiff, and it's then diagnosed with things such as hallux limitus and hallux rigidus. There are many things that can develop because of that, but the initial injury itself is just very acute. It can be because of certain factors such as a flatter foot, someone who excessively pronates, and those things have been there. Those have been there for a long period of time that can contribute to it, but the injury itself is just very acute.
Flat feet. The bones in your foot are in an arch. That's the way they're designed. Because of the pressure going down, those bones start to flatten out, and then in order to fix it or compensate for it, you need to get a foot insert to kind of raise those bones back up.
For more information about Steve Berkey and 90 Revolutions, visit 90revolutions.com.
That's exactly right. And also, flat feet can be the result of weakening of the muscles that support the arch. So flat feet is either structural, how the bones are shaped. Flat feet can also be acquired with the muscle tissue becomes weakened, as well as some of the ligamentous tissue that supports it. And oftentimes, when we do get shoes, they don't fit the arch exactly. There are a few of us that can get away with it and have great arch support, but oftentimes, even the arch support that's in the shoe is just not enough. And if you begin to feel that sensation where you can feel it on your arch and it begins to wear down, you may not be getting the proper arch support.
Is there a sign that you need an insert or an arch support insert? Does your foot start to hurt?
Yeah, definitely. If you need an arch support, some common signs that walkers or runners will talk about is that they have pain at the arch of their foot. They also may have some pain on the inside of their ankle because those ligaments and those tendons becoming excessively stretched. Sometimes people will, if it progresses to a certain point, they'll talk about morning pain. When they initially step onto their foot, it really hurts. They take a couple steps, it works its way out, and if they continue to walk, it begins to get really sore at the arch. They call that plantar fasciitis, but that's a sure sign that you need some more support.
Plantar fasciitis is kind of the technical make you scared word for flat feet.
It's actually a diagnosis that can occur because of flat feet.
Oh, so flat feet causes plantar fasciitis.
That's one contributing cause. Plantar fasciitis in itself is, in order to understand the diagnosis, you have to have a bit of an understanding of the anatomy. So the plantar fascia is actually the very fibrous, tight structure on the bottom of your foot that gives it nice support. When you're walking, that fascia has to stretch and accommodate to the different surfaces that you walk on. If you have some sort of foot dysfunction, so the foot's not moving for some reason in the correct fashion, too much stress is put on that tissue. And as with any type of tissue, it has a certain threshold. And if you push it too far, it begins to tear, and we have these micro tears that occur. The micro tears then lead to pain, so an inflammatory response is present. So this fascia now has become shortened because of tearing and the laying down the scar tissue, and it's almost like you're caught in this redundant cycle. Keep tearing it, hurting it, and the inflammatory process continues. So the only real way of preventing this tearing of that fascia, the tissue on the bottom of your foot, is really to port it, and then if it becomes chronic enough, call a medical professional. A medical professional may massage it, try to work out some of the scar tissue. Sometimes they'll use different types of anti-inflammatories, such as Aleve, and then finally showing you some stretching exercises just to restore the proper length of the tissue.
So that's what's going on. It's not long enough to support your foot and adjust itself to all the different surfaces that you're landing on, so it's just wearing out over time. It's not like the turf toe. It's not an acute injury. It's an overtime wearing out type of injury.
Exactly right. And it may be a matter of that it's not long enough, or there may be some sort of mechanical issue with the foot that's not operating properly. So it puts more stress on the fascia.
In order to stretch that out, grab your toes and pull your foot up. Is that the best way to do it, or is that what a doctor would do?
That's a similar stretch that they can do, where you extend your toes back. But also you have to focus on the contributing structures that may be causing the ankle to move improperly and cause stress on the fascia. For instance, if someone has a tight calf muscle, that's going to alter how the foot moves, how the ankle reacts to the ground. The weakest link then begins to take on the additional stress, your plantar fascia.
You know, it started with the flat foot discussion, so I guess if your foot starts to flatten out, that would kind of stretch that fascia and make it tighter. Just yesterday, I was playing baseball with my son, and he's 5, and he was running around in his Crocs because he wanted to run the bases, and I told him not to. There's a part on the Croc, and he got a blister. The best way to treat a blister is prevention, but once you've got one, what do you do?
Now, there's not really a certain professional secret to it. It's just make sure you prevent infection. So in other words, a Band-Aid, and if it does happen to break open for any reason, putting some antiseptic cream on there. Just, again, make sure that you don't get an infection.
No secret. Once you've got one, just cover it up, treat it like any other injury, and keep on going.
Exactly. Yeah, just consider it in a sense of it's kind of like if it does break open, an open wound, you've got to be careful. But when it boils down to prevention, it's really the biggest thing. Why do you have blisters? Well, blisters occur because of the excessive rubbing. So you're basically pushing beyond that threshold of your skin. The skin breaks down. So it could be that your son's foot was moving improperly in the Crocs. As a result, it caused all that excessive rubbing. So you may not have enough support at the arch of his foot in the Crocs. The Crocs are very comfortable, but they're very unsupportive.
While we're on feet, growing up, I did a little football and baseball and stuff, and I had weak ankles because I would always step wrong and my ankle would always roll, and it always rolled to the inside, never to the outside. But it happened consistently and constantly, and there was just some pain, but not enough to where I couldn't walk or not enough to where I was injured or anything. It was just a twisting of the ankle, limping a couple of steps, and then I would keep going. Is there a strengthening exercise, or is there a way to step differently than what the way I was stepping?
When you have these weak ankles and you have recurrent ankle sprains, you got to figure out why you're spraining it. You can't always control the way you step. We make several thousand steps per day, and we can't think about every step. One contributing cause, then, is potentially how you do step, but that's because of how your foot reacts to the ground. So in other words, we were talking earlier about how the outside of your shoe wears down. You may actually have a foot type in which you're contacting the outside of your foot, and instead of it rolling and absorbing the impact as your foot hits the ground, it could be locked into that inverted or tilted in position, and it could set you up for an ankle sprain. So the way to preventively address that would be with a specific type of insole. Sometimes you can use over-the-counter insoles, but oftentimes with that foot type, a custom orthotic is required to give you a little more support. Basically, it locks the heel in more of a neutral position so you don't fold in.
Just an insert for my foot. As I'm stepping, it would change the way my foot is landing on the ground, and that would more support the ankle?
Exactly. You have to figure out what you're trying to control. The recurrent ankle sprains are occurring because of the foot type, and you need to control the foot using, usually, it leads to a custom orthotic. Sometimes you can just use over-the-counter insoles, but if it's your heel is positioned in a way that's not, it's too much for over-the-counter insole to support, then you need something that cups it a little more. And a custom orthotic is when an individual would see a medical professional, whether they're a physical therapist, a podiatrist, or orthopedist, and they would cast their foot with plaster. That cast is then sent away to a company, and they make an insole that they stick in your shoe that's specific to your foot. So in that case, that type of foot type, that's when a custom orthotic is indicated. Now, we also have to consider, though, if you keep inverting your ankle or tilting your ankle in, leading to that ankle sprain, those ligaments have been stretched. Ligaments don't always shorten and heal in the normal functional position. Sometimes the damage is done if you keep twisting it so it becomes excessively stretched. If someone has a situation where those ligaments are so loose, that's when they need that lace-up ankle brace, especially if they're playing sports because they're going to be cutting and pivoting and putting a little more force through the ankle.
Those type that just go over top of your ankle. I don't know what they're called, but they're just sort of stretchy material with a hole cut out where the heel goes, and they just go over most of your foot and then, you know, a little bit up on the ankle. Do those do anything?
Those neoprene braces you're talking about.
That's it, neoprene.
They're intended. They give you a little support, but you don't want to rely on that by any means because there's not that much support. You need a lace-up or more of a Velcro type of brace where it has metal or plastic dais or rods on the side to prevent your ankle from rolling. Main purpose, though, for the neoprene brace or support is to control swelling and to provide warmth.
I'm from Fort Lauderdale, and of course, growing up, you know, I was a big Dolphins fan, and I remember Dan Marino snapped his Achilles. It was nothing. I mean, he just took a step back. I guess he stepped wrong or something, and when he tore it or snapped it, whatever you call it, I guess he was about my age now. I guess he was about 37. When it breaks like that, or as it's hurting, is it hurting before it breaks, or does it suddenly just snap or weakened over a period of use and abuse, or can it just happen to anybody just suddenly?
Usually when you have an Achilles rupture, there are some signs before that. You have some pain at the back of your heel, and you get diagnosis such as an Achilles tendonitis. And we have to be careful. We have to listen to those pains. Pain is almost like the check engine light of your car. If you don't pay attention to it, eventually your car is going to stop in most cases. But even though the car at the time seems like it's running fine, Well, pain's the same way. If you don't address it initially, then it leads to something bigger. In this case, an Achilles rupture. So an Achilles tendonitis is the overuse of the tendon. Tearing occurs, and eventually if it's weakened and not rehabbed correctly, then it can tear and become a much more serious injury. There are cases, though, that one time someone can tear their Achilles tendon, but usually there's a quite rare and it's quite an aggressive sports injury where someone may be pushing off their toes, running for a ball, but that's nowhere near as common.
So Marino probably had some pain back there prior to that injury. He's just being a guy and just working through it and not resting it or not getting some rehab or not healing it. He was just sucking it up and taking it and just trying to get through the season, and he didn't make it.
Exactly. I recently saw a patient this past week and addressing Achilles tendonitis, and she had the Achilles tendonitis for 2 to 3 years before she even decided to have something done with it. So meanwhile, she comes in, and her Achilles tendon is inflamed, it's thickened and swollen, discolored, and then eventually there's always that fear. Is she potentially going to have an Achilles tendon rupture if she doesn't get this addressed quickly?
For more interviews like this, visit medicinecoach.com.
How would you heal something like that, like an Achilles tendonitis?
Initially, when you see somebody with Achilles tendonitis, the first thing you want to focus on is decreasing the inflammation. And the way you do that is instruct them they can take anti-inflammatories, such as Aleve, to control the swelling initially. Also using ice periodically per day, about 2 to 3 times per day for 15 minutes. In addition, soft tissue mobilization or massage will help with the rehabbing the Achilles tendon. Oftentimes, because it has these micro tears, scar tissue is developed, and you must lengthen the Achilles tendon to its proper length so it doesn't develop further injury. And finally, once you have inflammation under control, the tendon has been restored to its normal length, you have to focus on strengthening and then look at the causes as a preventative measure. So strengthening exercises using a TheraBand, focusing on balance, and then eventually progressing to weight. And after the ankle is strong and rehab, the person may need some sort of special insole or custom orthotic to adjust any biomechanical issues with the foot. And if someone has a flatter foot or overpronates more, it's putting more stress on that Achilles tendon. So you have to correct that, or they could have it down the road again.
So to strengthen that Achilles tendon, just your basic calf raises, can you strengthen it?
There are multiple things to strengthen. When you're strengthening the ankle to support the Achilles tendon, you're doing activities such as heel raises, which focuses on the calf muscles, and you're doing those in specific ways. Also, you're going to focus on the musculature on the side of the ankle to prevent the heel from rolling in too much. So it's not as straightforward as simply doing heel raises. There's a lot more to it.
All these injuries, all these knee-down injuries, the best way to treat all these things is really just prevention, learning how to run, how to shuffle, how to sidestep, how to jump and land properly, and that just comes with good coaching, training, and the good medical people.
That's exactly right. If we put more of our emphasis into preventative care, things would be so much easier. People wouldn't have to go through the pain that they have been going through. And when we injure things, we have to keep in mind that oftentimes when you injure it, the damage is done, and it's not always going to be as good as new. So we can think preventatively versus, as we term it, tertiary care, or kind of after the fact, after your injury type care. A lot of things could be eliminated.
For the weekend warrior type, like me, if I'm not having any issues, is there any reason for me to seek out a professional for the proper foot placement or anything like that?
I would recommend that you just want to focus on general fitness, meaning that you don't necessarily in the beginning need to see a medical professional. In other words, the best professional would be the personal trainer, someone who's been well-educated orthopedically to know about injuries, but take more of a preventative approach. They're almost like your first door. If you do experience an injury, I think that resting it and then seeking a medical professional, that's your best bet.
These pro football players and basketball players, do they generally have professional on staff that specializes in this type of activities, analyzing each of these sports guys on a computer and all this other stuff to make sure that they're running and stepping properly, sort of preventing as many injuries as possible on that professional level?
If they're a professional athlete, they usually do have that convenience. If it's semi-pro or not semi-pro, oftentimes you don't see that much support given. But if they're professionals, definitely.
Best thing on injuries is just prevention.
Exactly.
I've seen this term trigger point therapy. What's trigger point therapy?
trigger point therapy, really to define it, again, we have to look at the anatomy of it. What is a trigger point? Sometimes we get stressed. Sometimes we overuse the muscle. And we get these knots in our muscle, if you want to think of it in that way. And it's a tightening of the muscle. It's almost like it's constantly contracted. There are many theories as to why we get trigger points, and they really haven't narrowed it down as to exactly why we get them. But we do know that stress induces them, overuse of them, the muscle induces them. And the trigger point therapy is intended to release that trigger point or release that knot. And the problem is if we continuously get these knots or these trigger points, it causes the muscle to tighten, it causes the muscle to become a weakened structure, and then that can lead to further problems because muscles in themselves, you're going to have pain if you have a trigger point, but we have to consider that the muscles are attached to things such as our bones. Specifically, if we have a trigger point in the shoulder muscles, the muscle attaches to our cervical vertebrae. If our vertebrae or neck bones are not moving correctly, that nerve can be aggravated, so it leads to a variety of things. The trigger point therapy in that fashion is actually, it's a great preventative type of treatment just to make sure that things that are more extreme do not happen.
They're just kind of a rubbing with your hand on a certain area that might be tense.
It comes in many forms. It could be the massaging type that you're talking about, rubbing with the hand. A massage therapist would be really your best preventative professional in that case.
If I'm having any type of pain as I'm running, jogging, you know, riding the bike or whatever, first step as sort of a weekend warrior would be what?
First step is I would look back at what you've been doing. Did you finally jump into the activity with no training? So I would look at your training schedule. If you're a weekend warrior, you may most likely just jumped into it.
That's probably what most of us guys are guilty of. But you're saying take it slow. Put your ego aside and just take it easy when you're starting.
Exactly. And we just have to consider certain things that our tissue hasn't adapted. And suddenly we're asking weakened tissue to perform some sort of more extreme task. And if we don't stretch and strengthen certain muscles, they're not really prepared for the task. And that's when we get into problems.
Is it good to stretch before or is it better to stretch after? Is it worth anything at all, stretching?
Stretch is extremely important. It's been linked to several injuries if someone's inflexible at certain areas. And when you stretch, you have to be careful in how you do it. You always want to warm up before you stretch. If you stretch a muscle that hasn't been warmed up and you didn't do an activity that brings proper blood flow and nutrients to the muscles, then there's an opportunity that you might actually injure yourself stretching. You might tear a muscle as a result. So the best thing is warm up, depending on the individual, but on average about 10 minutes, and then stretch. If you're going to do a certain task, such as a longer run, you might want to just slowly start out your running pace in a warm-up type of fashion, and then gradually ramp up into your racing pace. And then after you're done, stretching is appropriate. But you never want to do stretching in the beginning because that causes injuries.
In high school, we always stretched before. It shows you how much they know.
Yeah, I always, when I'm talking to patients, I try to explain to them that when you're warming up, you're bringing all those blood flow to your muscles, and your tissue is actually heating up in itself, and it's kind of like stretching taffy. Taffy is going to stretch a lot easier if you heat it. Same thing with your muscles. You have to heat it, stretch it.
Physical therapist, that is a medical professional who works with you, works with your body, shows you how to move properly to prevent injury, and if there is an injury, shows you how to prevent that from happening again or works you through the healing of that injury. Is that a decent assessment of a physical therapist?
I think that's definitely a decent assessment of a physical therapist, and maybe to elaborate, we have to think about how a physical therapist helps us through the process of healing. As a physical therapist, we're like biomechanical engineers, really. Similar to a mechanic, so our job is to figure out how things are moving, if they're moving properly, and why aren't they moving properly. And we have several tools and methods to address the healing process, whether it's calming the inflammation down using modalities, such as using ice, ultrasound, laser therapy. And then we use our hands a lot. Manual therapy is, they term it in the medical field. So whether it's some sort of massage, whether it's some sort of joint mobilization. And then finally, we re-educate the body and the person how to move properly.
So as a physical therapist, I come in, I twisted my knee, and I have not necessarily anything torn, but everything is just stretched. So as a physical therapist, you would show me how to not have that happen again, and you would help the connective tissue heal by manipulation or certain exercises?
Exactly. Once you address the situation of the injury, then we have to look at the preventative aspect of it, figure out, well, what caused this in the beginning, and what can we make sure that doesn't happen again to lead to the same injury.
I've also seen, you know, injuries and whatnot, and they say that so-and-so athlete, well, he went and got a cortisone injection into his joint. I can't think that that would be really a good thing to do to prevent the next injury.
I think that the best step in order to address an injury. As long as someone's not a professional athlete, I understand professional athletes have a lot of things riding on their contract or on the line, but if it's a recreational athlete or semi-pro, just be very conservative. Let the tissue heal, take a break from the activity, and use proper methods to address the inflammation, whether it's ice or some over-the-counter medication such as Aleve. So a cortisone injection, I wouldn't recommend that initially. They do have their place in the medical field if an injury has progressed to a certain point, but I would avoid it initially.
That was great. I don't really have any more questions, especially from knee down stuff. I mean, we covered the knee, we covered shin splints, we covered ankles, we covered turf toe, we covered flat feet. I learned a lot, so I mean, I really appreciate it, Steve, and hopefully a lot of other people listening will get some information from you.
Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate your time.
Good. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
All right, bye.
This is the end of this interview with Steve Berkey. I hope you've enjoyed it and learned a thing or two, as I have. If you want to contact Steve, you can get him through his website at 90revolutions.com. And remember to check back at my website, medicinecoach.com, for more interviews, articles, podcasts, and special reports.